This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to She Done It. I'm Caroline Crampton. A reminder before we begin that my new book, A Body Made of Glass, comes out very soon in April, just a few short weeks away, and that I'm doing an exclusive online launch on the 10th of April that you're all invited to. I hope it's going to be a good opportunity to chat and for me to answer your questions, including ones arising from this podcast. To find out more and sign up for it, head to carolinecrampton.com or the link in the description of this episode. Today on the podcast, I'm breaking the format a little bit. Sometimes I find it hard to let a topic go once I've published an installment of She Done It about it. And never has this been more true than with the Who Was Robert Eustace episode from November 2023. I got extremely into researching Eustace, who was this elusive early 20th century doctor who also moonlighted as a crime co-writer for two of my favourite authors to study, L.T. Meade and Dorothy L. Sayers. And I haven't really stopped researching him, even though the episode I was making has been out for 4 months at this point, and I have new subjects to look into for future episodes. I'm still trying to track down and read as much of his fiction as I can, and in the process of doing so, I came across what I think might be one of my favourite crime fiction short stories ever. And so I'm going to share it with you today, in the hope of inducting a few more people into my Robert Eustace obsession. The story in question is from 1925, and it was co-written by Robert Eustace with Edgar Jepson. Jepson was a journalist and a writer who is probably best known today for his translations of the Arsène Lupin stories into English, but who did also write a lot of crime and adventure stories for the press. Robert Eustace, as you will know if you heard that episode all about him from last year, was really a medical doctor named Eustace Robert Barton, who mostly collaborated on crime fiction that had a scientific element to it. And this tale is no exception. What you're about to hear is an impossible crime story that wonderfully incorporates science into both the dastardly deed and the detection thereof. It also has an intriguing and skilled heroine, a romantic subplot, and a dramatic courtroom scene. In short, everything that I like in a mystery. It's narrated in the first person from the point of view of an unnamed friend of the main characters and centres upon the momentous meeting of two former friends in a Turkish bath in central London. I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. The Tea Leaf by Edgar Jepson and Robert Eustace. Arthur Kelston and George Willerton met in the Turkish bath in Duke Street, St. James's, and rather more than a year later, in that Turkish bath, they parted. Both of them were bad-tempered men, Kelston cantankerous and Willerton violent. It was indeed difficult to decide which was the worst-tempered, and when I found that they had suddenly become friends, I gave that friendship 3 months. It lasted nearly a year. When they did quarrel, they quarrelled about Kelston's daughter Ruth. Willerton fell in love with her and she with him, and they became engaged to be married. 6 months later, in spite of the fact that they were plainly very much in love with one another, the engagement was broken off. Neither of them gave any reason for breaking it off. My belief was that Willerton had given Ruth a taste of his infernal temper and got as good as he gave. Not that Ruth was at all like a Kelston to look at. Like the members of most of the old Lincolnshire families, descendants of the Vikings and the followers of Canute, one Kelston is very like another Kelston, fair-haired, clear-skinned, with light blue eyes and a good bridge to the nose. But Ruth had taken after her mother. She was dark, with a straight nose, dark brown eyes of the kind often described as liquid, dark brown hair and as kissable lips as I ever saw. She was a proud, rather self-sufficing, high-spirited girl with a temper of her own. She needed it to live with that cantankerous old brute Kelston. Oddly enough, in spite of the fact that he would always try to bully her, she was fond of him, and I will say for him that he was very fond of her. Probably she was the only creature in the world of whom he was really fond. He was an expert in the application of scientific discoveries to industry, and she worked with him in his laboratory. He paid her $500 a year, so that she must have been uncommonly good. He took the breaking off of the engagement very hard indeed. He would have it that Willerton had jilted her. Ruth took it hard too. Her warm colouring lost some of its warmth. Her lips grew less kissable and set in a thinner line. Willerton's temper grew worse than ever. He was like a bear with a perpetually sore head. I tried to feel my way with both him and Ruth, with a view to help bring about a reconciliation. To put it mildly, I was rebuffed. Willerton swore at me. Ruth flared up and told me not to meddle in matters that didn't concern me. Nevertheless, my strong impression was that they were missing one another badly, and would have been glad enough to come together again if their stupid vanity could have let them. Kelston did his best to keep Ruth furious with Willerton. One night I told him, it was no business of mine, but I never did give a tinker's curse for his temper, that he was a fool to meddle and had much better leave them alone. It made him furious, of course. He would have it that Willerton was a dirty hound and a low blackguard. At least those were the mildest things he said of him. It struck me of a sudden that there must be something much more serious in the breaking off of the engagement than I had guessed. That suspicion was strengthened by the immense trouble Kelston took to injure Willerton. At his clubs, the Athenaeum, the Devonshire and the Savile, he would display an astonishing ingenuity in bringing the conversation round to Willerton. Then he would declare that he was a scoundrel and a blackguard of the meanest type. Of course it did Willerton harm, though not nearly as much harm as Kelston desired, for Willerton knew his job as few engineers knew it, and it is very hard to do much harm to a man who really knows his job. People have to have him. But of course it did him some harm, and Willerton knew that Kelston was doing it. I came across two men who told me that they had given him a friendly hint. That did not improve Willerton's temper. As an expert in the construction of those ferro-concrete buildings which are rising up all over London, he was as distinguished in his sphere as Kelston was in his. They were alike not only in the matters of brains and bad temper, but I think their minds worked in very much the same way. At any rate, both of them seemed determined not to change their ordinary course of life because of the breaking off of that engagement. It had been the habit of both of them to have a Turkish bath at the Baths in Duke Street at 4 in the afternoon on the second and last Tuesday in every month. To that habit, they stuck. The fact that they must meet on those Tuesdays did not cause either of them to change his hour of taking his Turkish bath by the 20 minutes which would have given them no more than a passing glimpse of one another. They continued to take it, as they always had, simultaneously. Thick-skinned? They were thick-skinned. Neither of them pretended that he did not see the other. He scowled at him, and he scowled at him most of the time. I know this, for sometimes I had a Turkish bath myself at the same hour. It was about 3 months after the breaking off of the engagement that they met for the last time at that Turkish bath, and there parted for good. Kelston had been looking ill for about 6 weeks. There was a greyness and a drawn look to his face, and he was losing weight. On the second Tuesday in October, he arrived at the bath punctually at 4, bringing with him, as was his habit, a thermos flask full of a very delicate China tea. If he thought that he was not perspiring freely enough, he would drink it in the hottest room. If he did perspire freely enough, he would drink it after his bath. Willerton arrived about 2 minutes later. Kelston finished undressing and went into the bath a couple of minutes before Willerton. They stayed in the hot room about the same time. Kelston went into the hottest room about a minute after Willerton. Before he went into it, he sent for his thermos flask, which he had left in the dressing room, and took it into the hottest room with him. As it happened, they were the only two people in the hottest room, and they had not been in it 2 minutes, before the four men in the hot room heard them quarrelling. They heard Kelston call Willerton a dirty hound and a low blackguard, among other things, and declare he would do him in yet. Willerton told him to go to the devil twice. Kelston went on abusing him, and presently Willerton fairly shouted, "Oh, shut up, you old fool, or I'll make you!" Kelston did not shut up. About 2 minutes later, Willerton came out of the hottest room, scowling, walked through the hot room into the shampooing room, and put himself into the hands of one of the shampooers. 2 or 3 minutes after that, a man of the name of Helston went into the hottest room and fairly yelled. Kelston was lying back on a blood-drenched couch, with the blood still flowing from a wound over his heart. There was a devil of a hullabaloo. The police were called in, Willerton arrested. Of course he lost his temper, and protesting furiously that he had nothing to do whatever with the crime, abused the police. That did not incline them to believe him. After examining the room and the dead body, The detective inspector in charge of the case came to the conclusion that Kelston had been stabbed as he was drinking his tea. The thermos flask lay on the floor in front of him, and some of the tea had evidently been spilt, for some tea leaves, the tea in the flask must have been carelessly strained of the leaves by the maid who filled it, lay on the floor about the mouth of the empty flask. It looked as if the murderer had taken advantage of Kelston's drinking his tea to stab him, while the flask rather blocked his vision and prevented him from seeing what he would be at. The case would have been quite plain sailing, but for the fact that they could not find the weapon. It had been easy enough for Willerton to take it into the bath in the towel in which he was draped. But how had he got out of it? Where had he hidden it? A Turkish bath is no place to hide anything in. It is as bare as an empty barn, if anything barer, and Willerton had been in the barest part of it. The police searched every part of it. Not that there was much point in doing that, for Willerton had come out of the hottest room and gone through the hot room into the shampooer's room. When Helston started shouting murder, Willerton had rushed back with the shampooers to the hottest room, and there he had stayed. Since it was obvious that he had committed the murder, the shampooers and the bathers had kept their eyes on him. They were all of them certain that he had not left them to go to the dressing rooms. They would not have allowed him to do so. It was obvious that he must have carried the weapon into the bath, hidden in the folds of the towel in which he was draped, and brought it away in the folds of that towel. He had laid the towel down beside the couch on which he was being shampooed, and there it still lay when they came to look for it, untouched, with no weapon in it, with no traces of blood on it.
If you're a fan of She Done It, then I know you love a good mystery. And oh boy, have I got one to share with you today. The Crossbow Killer is a narrative true crime podcast like no other, set in Holy Island, North Wales. Using atmospheric recordings, surprising interviews, and a compelling documentary narrative, it tells the story of Gerald Corrigan, a quiet man with seemingly no enemies, who was murdered in cold blood by a single shot to the chest from a crossbow. As one of the interviewees says, who on earth would have a crossbow in the middle of the night in rural Anglesey? But somebody did. It didn't help the investigation that this bizarre murder took place in one of the most isolated and remote corners of the UK. The police had no witnesses and virtually no hard evidence. Yet slowly, clues started to unfold, pointing towards an enthralling network of double-crossing, extortion, secret trysts and financial greed, plus a possible suspect. I especially found that the innovative use of music, the soundscapes and the writing of this show really set it apart from your average true crime series. Presented and produced by Meg Parry and narrated by acclaimed British-Danish storyteller Tim Hinman, this podcast tells a truly compelling and baffling story and paints an immersive and captivating picture in sound. Head over to the BBC Sounds app to listen to The Crossbow Killer now.
There was not much in the fact that it was not stained with blood, since Willerton could have wiped the knife or dagger or whatever weapon he used on the couch on which Kelston lay. There were no marks of any such wiping on the couch, but the blood flowing from the wound might have covered them up. There was no finding the weapon, and its disappearance puzzled the police and later puzzled the public. Then the doctors who made the autopsy came to the conclusion that the wound had been inflicted by a circular, pointed weapon nearly 3/4 of an inch in diameter. It had penetrated rather more than 3 inches, and supposing that its handle was only 4 inches long, it must have been a sizeable weapon, quite impossible to overlook. The doctors also discovered a further proof of the theory that Kelston had been drinking his tea when he was stabbed. Halfway down the wound, they found 2 halves of a tea leaf which had evidently fallen onto Kelston's body, been driven into the wound, and cut in half by the weapon. Also, they discovered that Kelston was suffering from cancer. This fact was not published in the papers. I heard it at the Devonshire. Willerton was brought before the magistrates, and to most people's surprise, did not reserve his defence. He went into the witness box and swore that he had never touched Kelston, that he had never had anything to touch him with, that he had never taken any weapon into the Turkish bath, and so had had no weapon to hide, that he had never ever seen any such weapon as the doctors described. He was committed for trial. The papers were full of the crime. Everyone was discussing it, and the question which occupied everyone's mind was, where had Willerton hidden the weapon? People wrote to the papers to suggest that he had ingeniously put it in some place under everybody's eyes, and that it had been overlooked because it was so obvious. Others suggested that, circular and pointed, it must be very like a thick lead pencil, that it was a thick lead pencil, and that was why the police had overlooked it in their search. The police had not overlooked any thick lead pencil. There had been no thick lead pencil to overlook. They hunted England, though. Willerton did a lot of motoring, to discover the man who had sold him this curious and uncommon weapon. They did not find the man who had sold it to him. They did not find a man who sold such weapons at all. They came to the conclusion that Kelston had been murdered with a piece of steel or iron rod filed to a point like a pencil. In spite of the fact that only Willerton could have murdered Kelston, I could not believe that he had done it. The fact that Kelston was doing his best to injure him professionally and socially was by no means a strong enough motive. Willerton was far too intelligent a man not to be well aware that people do not take much notice of statements to the discredit of a man whom they need to do a job for them. And for the social injury, he would care very little. Besides, he might very well injure or even kill a man in one of his tantrums, but his was not the kind of bad temper that plans a cold-blooded murder. And if ever a murder had been deliberately planned, Kelston's had. I was as close a friend as Willerton had, and I went to visit him in prison. He seemed rather touched by my doing so, and grateful. I learned that I was the only person who had done so. He was subdued and seemed much gentler. It might last. He discussed the murder readily enough and naturally with a harassed air. He said quite frankly that he did not expect me, in the circumstances, to believe that he had not committed it, but he had not, and could not for the life of him conceive who had. I did not believe that he had not committed it, but there was something in his way of discussing it that wholly convinced me. I told him that I was quite sure that he had not killed Kelston, and he looked at me as if he did not believe the assurance. But again, he looked grateful. Ruth was grieving for her father, but Willerton's very dangerous plight to some degree distracted her mind from the loss. A woman can quarrel with a man bitterly without desiring to see him hanged, and Willerton's chance of escaping hanging was not at all a good one. But she would not believe for a moment that he had murdered her father. "No, there's nothing in it, nothing whatsoever," she said firmly. "If Dad had murdered Hugh, I could have understood it. He had reasons, or at any rate he had persuaded himself that he had. But whatever reason had Hugh for murdering Dad? It's all nonsense to suppose that he'd mind Dad's trying all he knew to injure him as much as that. All kinds of people are going about trying to injure other people in that way, but they don't really injure them very much, and Hugh knows that quite well. Of course they don't. And Hugh wouldn't really believe that your father was injuring him much," I said. "But you're forgetting his infernal temper." "No, I'm not," she protested. "He might kill a man in one of his rages or on the spur of the moment, but this wasn't the spur of the moment. Whoever did it had worked the whole thing out and come along with his weapon ready." I had to admit that that was reasonable enough. But who had done it? I pointed out to her that the police had made careful inquiries about everyone in the bath at the time, the shampooers and the people taking their baths, but they had found no evidence whatever that any one of them had at any time had any relations, except that of shampooer, with her father. Either it was one of them, or somebody else who just did it and got right away. "Or there's a catch somewhere," she said, frowning thoughtfully. "I can't see how there can possibly have been anyone in the bath, except the people who are known to have been there," said I. "In fact, there can't have been." Then the Crown subpoenaed her as a witness for the prosecution. It seemed rather unnecessary and even a bit queer, for it could have found plenty of evidence of bad blood between the two men without dragging her into it. Plainly it was bent on doing all it knew to prove motive enough. Ruth seemed more upset by the prospect of going into the witness box than I should have expected her to be, but then she had been having a very trying time. On the morning of the trial, I called for her after breakfast to drive her down to the New Bailey. She was pale and looked as if she had had a poor night's rest, and naturally enough she seemed to be suffering from an excitement she had to control. It was not like her to show any excitement she might be feeling. We had, of course, been in close touch with Willerton's solicitor, Hamley, and he had kept seats for us just behind him. He wished to have Ruth at hand, should some point turn up upon which she could throw light, since she knew more than anyone about the relations between Willerton and her father. I had timed our arrival very well. The jury had just been sworn in. Of course the court was full of women, the wives of peers and bookmakers and politicians, most of them overdressed and over-scented. Then the judge came in, and with his coming the atmosphere of the court became charged with that sense of anxious strain peculiar to trials for murder. It was rather like the atmosphere of a sick room in the case of a fatal illness, but worse. It was unfortunate for Willerton that the judge was garbled. A hard-faced, common-looking fellow, and coarse in the grain, he has a well-founded reputation as a hanging judge, and the habit of acting as an extra counsel for the prosecution. Willerton came into the box, looking under the weather and very much subdued, but he certainly looked dignified, and he said that he was not guilty in a steady enough voice. Greatrix, the leading counsel for the Crown, opened the case for the prosecution. There was no suggestion in his speech that the police had discovered any new fact. Then Helston gave evidence of finding the body of the dead man, and he and the other three men who had been with him in the hot room gave evidence of the quarrel they had overheard between Willerton and the dead man, and that Willerton came out of the hottest room scowling and obviously furious. One of them, a fussy old gentleman of the name of Underwood, declared that it was the bitterest quarrel he had ever heard. None of the four of them could throw any light on the matter of whether Willerton was carrying the missing weapon in the folds of the towel in which he was draped. All of them were sure that he had nothing in his hands. The medical evidence came next. In cross-examining the doctors who had made the autopsy, Hazeldine, Willerton's counsel, established the fact quite definitely that the missing weapon was of a fair size, that its rounded blade must have been over half an inch in diameter and between 3 and 4 inches long. They were of the opinion that to drive a blade of that thickness into the heart, a handle of at least 4 inches in length would be necessary to give a firm enough grip. It might have been a piece of steel or iron rod, sharpened like a pencil. At any rate, it was certainly a sizeable weapon, not one to be hidden quickly, or to disappear wholly in a Turkish bath. Hazeldine could not shake their evidence about the tea leaf. They were confident that it had been driven into the wound and cut in half by the blade of the missing weapon. That went to show that the wound had been inflicted while Kelston was drinking his tea. Detective Inspector Brackett, who was in charge of the case, was cross-examined at great length about his search for the missing weapon. He made it quite clear that nowhere in the Turkish bath was it to be found, neither in the hot rooms, nor the shampooing room, nor the dressing rooms, nor the vestibule, nor the office. He had had the plunge bath emptied, he had searched the roofs, though it was practically certain that the skylight above the hot room, not the hottest, had been shut at the time of the crime. In re-examination, he scouted the idea of Willerton's having had an accomplice who had carried away the weapon for him. He had gone into that matter most carefully. The shampooer stated that Willerton came to him scowling so savagely that he wondered what had put him into such a bad temper. In cross-examining him, Arbuthnot, Hazeldine's junior, made it clearer than ever that, unless Willerton had already hidden the weapon in the bare hottest room, it was hidden in the towel. Then he drew from the shampooer the definite statement that Willerton had set down the towel beside the couch on which he was shampooed, that he had hurried back to the hot rooms in front of the shampooer, that the shampooer had come back from the hot rooms, leaving Willerton still in them discussing the crime, to find the towel lying just as Willerton had set it down, with no weapon in it and no trace of blood on it. Since the inspector had disposed of the possibility that an accomplice had slipped in, taken the weapon from the towel and slipped out of the bath with it, this evidence really made it clear that the weapon had never left the hottest room. Then the prosecution called evidence of the bad terms on which Kelston and Willerton had been. Three well-known and influential men told the jury about Kelston's efforts to prejudice Willerton in their eyes, and the damaging statements he had made about them. One of them had felt it to be his duty to tell Willerton about this, and Willerton had been very angry. Arbuthnot, in cross-examining, elicited the fact that any damaging statement that Kelston made about anyone was considerably discounted by the fact that everyone knew him to be, in the highest degree, cantankerous. I noticed that during the end of the cross-examination of the shampooer, and during this evidence, Ruth had been fidgeting and turning to look impatiently at the entrance of the court, as if she was expecting someone. Then, just as she was summoned to the witness box, there came in a tall, stooping, grey-headed, grey-bearded man of about 60, carrying a brown paper parcel. His face was familiar to me, but I could not place him. He caught her eye and nodded to her. She breathed a sharp sigh of relief and bent over and handed a letter she had in her hand to Willerton's solicitor and pointed out the grey-bearded man to him. Then she went quietly to the witness box. Hamley read the letter, and at once bent over and handed it to Hazeldine and spoke to him. I caught a note of excitement in his hushed voice. Hazeldine read the letter, and appeared to grow excited too. Hamley slipped out of his seat and went to the grey-bearded man who was still standing just inside the door of the court, and began to talk to him earnestly. Greatrix began to examine Ruth, and naturally I turned my attention to her. His examination was directed also to show on what bad terms Kelston and Willerton had been. Ruth was called on to tell the jury some of Kelston's actual threats. Then, it is astonishing how few things the police fail to ferret out in a really important case, the examination took a curious turn. Greatrix began to question Ruth about her own relations with Willerton, and the plain trend of his questions was to bring out the fact that they had not merely been engaged to be married, but had also been lovers. I saw at once what the prosecution was aiming at. It was trying to make use of the tendency of a British jury and a British judge in a natural effort to champion morality, to hang a man or woman who is on trial for murder for behaving immorally in relations with the other sex. There was no better way of prejudicing Willerton than by proving that he had seduced Ruth under the promise of marriage. Of course, Hazeldene was on his feet at once, protesting that this evidence was irrelevant and inadmissible. And of course, Garbold was against him. He does not enjoy the nickname by which he is known to the junior bar for nothing. Hazeldene was magnificent. He had one of the worst rows with Garbold he had ever had, and he has had many. Garbold is a fool to let him have these rows. Hazeldene always gets the better of him, or seems to, and it does him good with the jury. But then Garbold was raised to the bench not for intelligence, but for political merit. He ruled that the questions were admissible, and put one or two to Ruth himself. Then Willerton lost his temper, and protested that this had nothing to do with the case and that it was an outrage. Willerton has a ringing voice of considerable volume. He is not at all an easy man to hush when he does not wish to hush. And there was some time hushing him. By the time they had succeeded, Garbold was purplish red with fury. Anything that he could do to hang Willerton would certainly be done. But observing the jury, my impression was that Willerton's outburst had done him good with it, and that Hazeldene's protests had weakened its confidence in Garbold. When I looked at the faces, just a trifle sickly, of the counsel for the prosecution, I felt sure that the Crown had bungled this business rather badly. Greatrix, assisted by Garbold, went on with his questions, and Ruth, defiant rather than abashed, and looking in her flushed animation a more charming creature than ever, admitted that she and Willerton had been lovers, that more than once when he had brought her home from a dance or theatre he had not left her till the early morning. One of the maids had spied on them, and the Crown had the facts. I was afraid, in spite of Hazeldene's protests, that the fact that Willerton had seduced her under the promise of marriage, as Greatrix put it, would do him great harm with the jury. Very likely it would hang him. Then Ruth, still flushed but not greatly discomposed, said, "That would be a reason for my father's murdering Mr. Willerton, not for Mr. Willerton's murdering my father." That brought Garbold down upon her like a ton of bricks. She was there to answer questions, not make idle remarks and so forth and so on. Then Greatrix came to the breaking off of the engagement, and put it to her that Willerton had broken it off, had in fact jilted her after compromising her. That she would not have for a moment. She declared that they had had a quarrel, and she had broken it off. To that she stuck, and there was no shaking her, though Garbold himself took a hearty hand in trying to shake her. In the middle of it, Willerton, who was looking quite himself again, now that the atmosphere of the court might be said to be charged almost with violence, said in a very unpleasant, jeering voice, "What she says is perfectly true. What's the good of bothering her?" Again Garbold was to the fore, and angrily reprimanded him for speaking, bade him keep silent, and said that he would not have his court turned into a bear garden. "With the bear on the bench," said Hazeldene to Arbuthnot, in a whisper that carried well. Two or three people laughed. One of them was a juryman. By the time Garbold had finished with him, I did not think that that juryman would have convicted Willerton if he had actually seen him stab Kelston. Willerton was writing a note which was passed to Hazeldene. Hazeldene rose to cross-examine Ruth with a wholly confident air. He drew from her the fact that her father had been on excellent terms with Willerton until the breaking off of the engagement, that in that matter he had taken her part warmly, and that when the maid who had spied upon them had informed him of her relations with Willerton, he had been very little more enraged than he was already. Then Hazeldene asked, "Is it a fact that since the breaking off of your engagement, the prisoner has more than once begged you to forgive him and renew it?" "Four times," said Ruth. "And you refused?" "Yes," said Ruth. She looked at Willerton queerly and added, "He wanted a lesson." "Did he then beg you at least to go through the form of marriage with him and promise to leave you at the church door?" "Yes." "And you refused?" "Yes," said Ruth. Garbold bent forward and said in his most unpleasant tone, "And why did you reject the opportunity of repairing your shameful behaviour?" "It wasn't shameful," Ruth almost snapped, and she scowled at him frankly. Then she added naively, "I refused because there was no hurry. He would always marry me if I changed my mind and wanted to." There was a pause. To me it seemed clearer than ever that the Crown had bungled badly in raising the questions of the relations between her and Willerton, since he had evidently been more than ready to save her from any harm that might come of their indiscretion. But then, with a jury, you can never tell.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud. Or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Then Hazeldine started on a fresh line. In sympathetic accents, he asked, "Is it a fact that your father was suffering from cancer in a painful form?" "It was beginning to grow very painful," said Ruth sadly. "Did he make a will and put all his affairs in order a few days before he died?" "3 days," said Ruth. "Did he ever express an intention of committing suicide?" "He said that he would stick it out a little while and then end it all," said Ruth. She paused and added, "And that is what he did do." One might almost say that the court started. I think that everyone in it moved a little, so there was a kind of rustling murmur. Garbold threw himself back in his seat with a snort of incredulity and glowered at Ruth. "Will you tell the court your reasons for that statement?" said Hazeldine. Ruth seemed to pull herself together. The flush had faded from her face and she was looking very tired. Then she began in a quiet, even voice, "I never believed for a moment that Mr. Willerton murdered my father. If my father had murdered Mr. Willerton, it would have been a different matter." Garbold leaned forward and snarled that it was not her beliefs or fancies that were wanted, but facts. I did not think that she heard him. She was concentrating on giving her reasons exactly. She went on in the same quiet tone. "Of course, like everybody else, I puzzled over the weapon, what it was and where it had got to. I did not believe that it was a pointed piece of a half-inch steel rod. If anybody had come into the Turkish bath meaning to murder my father and hide the weapon, they wouldn't have used one so big and difficult to hide, when a hatpin would have done just as well and could be hidden much more easily. But what puzzled me most was the tea leaf in the wound. All the other tea leaves that came out of the flask were lying on the floor. Inspector Brackett told me they were, and I couldn't believe that one tea leaf had fallen onto my father at the very place above his heart at which the point of the weapon had penetrated the skin and got driven in by it. That was too much of a coincidence for me to swallow. But I got no nearer understanding it than anyone else." Garbold broke in a tone of some exasperation and told her to come to the facts. Hazeldine rose and protested that the witness should not be interrupted, that she had solved a mystery which had puzzled some of the best brains in England, and she should be allowed to tell her story in her own way. Again, Ruth did not appear to listen to them, and when they stopped, she went on in the same quiet voice. "Of course, I remembered that Dad talked about putting an end to it, but no one with a wound like that could get up and hide the weapon. Then, the night before last, I dreamt that I went into the laboratory and saw a piece of steel rod, pointed, lying on the table at which my father used to work." "Dreams now," murmured Garbold contemptuously, and he leaned back and folded his hands over his stomach. "I didn't think much of the dream, of course," Ruth went on. "I had been puzzling about it all so hard for so long that it was only natural to dream about it. But after breakfast I had a sudden feeling that the secret was in the laboratory, if I could only find it. I did not attach any importance to the feeling, but it went on growing stronger, and after lunch I went to the laboratory and began to hunt. I looked through all the drawers and could find nothing. Then I went round the room looking at everything and into everything, instruments and retorts and tubes and so on. Then I went into the middle of the floor and looked slowly round the room pretty hard. Against the wall, near the door, lying ready to be taken away, was a gas cylinder. I rolled it over to see what gas had been in it, and it had no label on it." She paused to look around the court as if claiming its best attention. Then she went on. "Now, that was very queer, because every gas cylinder must have a label on it. So many gases are dangerous. I turned on the cylinder, and nothing came out of it. It was quite empty. Then I went to the book in which all the things which come in are entered, and found that 10 days before Dad died he had had in a cylinder of carbon dioxide and 7 pounds of ice. Also he had had 7 pounds of ice every day until the day of his death. It was the ice and the carbon dioxide together that gave me the idea. Carbon dioxide has a very low freezing point, 80 degrees centigrade, and as it comes out of the cylinder and mixes with the air, it turns into very fine snow, and that snow, if you compress it, makes the hardest and toughest ice possible. It flashed on me. Dad could have collected this snow and forced it into a mould and made a weapon that would not only inflict that wound, but would disappear instantly." She paused again to look round the court, at about as rapt a lot of faces as any narrator could desire. Then she went on. "I knew that that was what he had done. I knew it for certain. carbon dioxide ice would make a hard, tough dagger, and it would melt quickly in the hottest room of a Turkish bath and leave no smell because it is scentless, so there wouldn't be any weapon. And it explained the tea leaf too. Dad had made a carbon dioxide dagger perhaps a week before he used it, perhaps only a day, and he had put it in the thermos flask as soon as he had made it. The thermos flask keeps out the heat as well as the cold, you know. But to make sure that it couldn't melt at all, he kept the flask in ice till he was ready to use the dagger. It's the only way you can explain that tea leaf. It came out of the flask, sticking to the point of the dagger, and was driven into the wound. She paused again, and one might almost say that the court heaved a deep sigh of relief. Then Garbald asked in an unpleasant and incredulous voice, "Why didn't you take this fantastic theory straight to the police?" "But that wouldn't have been any good," she protested quickly. "It was no use my knowing it myself. I had to make other people believe it. I had to find evidence. I began to hunt for it. I felt in my bones that there was some. What I wanted was the mould. And I found it." She uttered the words in a tone of triumph and smiled at Willerton. Then she went on, "At least I found bits of it. In the box into which we used to throw odds and ends, scraps of material, damaged instruments and broken test tubes, I found some pieces of vulcanite, and I saw at once they were bits of a vulcanite container. I took some wax and rolled it into a rod about the right size, and then I pieced the container together on the outside of it. At least most of it. There are some small pieces missing. It took me nearly all night, but I found the most important bit, the pointed end." She dipped into her handbag and drew out a black object about 9 inches long and 3/4 of an inch thick, and held it up for everyone to see. Someone, without thinking, began to clap, and there came a storm of applause that drowned the voice of the clerk calling for order and the bellowing of Garbald. When the applause died down, Hazeldine, who never misses the right moment, said, "I have no more questions to ask the witness, my lord," and sat down. That action seemed to clinch it in my eyes, and I have no doubt it clinched it in the eyes of the jury. The purple Garbald leaned forward and almost bellowed at Ruth, "Do you expect the jury to believe that a well-known man like your father died in the act of deliberately setting a dastardly trap to hang the prisoner?" Ruth looked at him, shrugged her shoulders, and said, with a calm acceptance of the facts of human nature one would expect to find only in a much older woman, "Oh well, Daddy was like that, and he certainly believed he had very good reasons for killing Mr. Willerton." There was that in her tone and manner which made it absolutely certain that Kelston was not only like that, but that he had acted according to his nature. Greatrix did not re-examine Ruth. He conferred with Hazeldine. Then Hazeldine rose to open the case for the defence. He said that he would not waste the time of the court, and that in view of the fact that Miss Kelston had solved the problem of her father's death, he would only call one witness, Professor Moseley. The grey-headed, grey-bearded, stooping man, who had come to the court so late, went into the witness box. Of course, his face had been familiar to me. I had seen his portrait in the newspapers 12 times. He still carried the brown paper parcel. In answer to Hazeldine's questions, he stated that it was possible, not even difficult, to make a weapon of carbon dioxide hard enough and tough enough and sharp enough to inflict such a wound as that which had caused Kelston's death. The method of making it was to fold a piece of chamois leather into a bag, hold that bag with the left hand, protected by a glove, over the nozzle of a cylinder containing liquid carbon dioxide, and open the valve with the right hand. Carbon dioxide evaporates so quickly that its freezing point, 80 degrees centigrade, is soon reached, and it solidifies in the chamois leather bag as a deposit of carbon dioxide snow. Then turn off the gas, spoon that snow into a vulcanite container of the required thickness, and ram it down with a vulcanite plunger into a rod of the required hardness. He added that it was advisable to pack the container in ice while filling it and ramming down the snow, then put the rod into a thermos flask, and keep it till it is needed. "And you have made such a rod?" said Hazeldine. "Yes," said the professor, cutting the string of the brown paper parcel. "When Miss Kelston hauled me out of bed at 7:30 this morning to tell me her discoveries, I perceived at once that she had found the solution of the problem of her father's death, which had puzzled me considerably. I had breakfast quickly, and got to work to make such a weapon myself for the satisfaction of the court. Here it is." He drew a thermos flask from the brown paper, unscrewed the top of it, and inverted it. There dropped into his gloved hand a white rod about 8 inches long. He held it out for the jury to see. "This carbon dioxide ice is the hardest and toughest we know of, and I have no doubt that Mr. Kelston killed himself with a similar rod. The difference between the rod he used and this, that his rod was pointed. I had no pointed vulcanite container, but the container that Miss Kelston pieced together is pointed. Doubtless Mr. Kelston had it specially made, probably by Messrs. Hawkins and Spender. He dropped the rod back into the thermos flask and screwed on the top. Hazeldine sat down. The juryman who had been reprimanded by Garbold leaned forward and spoke earnestly to the forum. Greatrix rose. With regard to the point of the rod, Professor Moseley, would it remain sharp long enough to pierce the skin in that heat? He asked. In my opinion, it would, said the professor. I have been considering that point, and bearing in mind the facts that Mr. Kelston would, from his avocation, be very deft with his hands, and being a scientific man, would know exactly what to do, he would have the rod out of the flask and the point in position in very little more than a second, perhaps less. He would, I think, hold it in his left hand and drive it home by striking the butt of it hard with his right. The whole thing would take him 2 seconds. Besides, if the point of the weapon had melted, the tea leaf would have fallen off it. Thank you, said Greatrix, and turned and conferred with the Crown solicitors. Then he said, We do not propose to proceed with the case, my lord. The foreman of the jury rose quickly and said, And the jury doesn't want to hear anything more, my lord. We're quite satisfied that the prisoner isn't guilty. Garbold hesitated. For 2 pins he would have directed the case to proceed. Then his eye fell on Hazeldine, who was watching him. I fancied he decided not to give him a chance of saying more disagreeable things. Looking black enough, he put the question formally to the jury, who returned a question of not guilty, and then he discharged Willerton. I came out of the court with Ruth, and we waited for Willerton. Presently he came out of the door and stopped and shook himself. Then he saw Ruth and came to her. They did not greet one another. She just slipped her hand through his arm, and they walked out of the New Bailey together. We made a good deal of noise, cheering them. This episode of She Done It was produced and hosted by me, Caroline Crampton. You can find more information about this episode at shedoneitshow.com/thetealeaf. I publish transcripts of every episode, including this one. Find them all at shedoneitshow.com/transcripts. Don't forget that my new book, A Body Made of Glass, is out in April and currently available for pre-order everywhere books are sold or borrowed. And there's an exclusive ebook and online launch event just for those who pre-order. Check the description of this episode or head to carolinecrampton.com to take part, where you'll also find details of the events, both in person and online, I'm doing over the next few months. She Done It is edited by Ewan McAleese. Production assistance from Leandra Griffith. Member support for the She Done It book club from CC McLaughlin. Thanks for listening.